Thank you for using Global Pill Link.
Hey, Maggie, I wanted to say this before you ask your question.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I read this book. It's called To Kill a Mockingbird, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of feeling like the modern-day Tom Robinson. And I can say that I can relate to Tom because better than anybody because I know what it feels like to be falsely accused.
Mm-hmm.
And then that book like shows what happens to someone that looks like me in our judicial system.
This is Brandon Spencer. I've known Brandon since 2020 when I first reported on his case.
Brandon, you were so young when you went to prison. How old were you?
I got arrested at 19, but when I actually went to CDCR, I was 21.
Brandon grew up in prison. He's been in over 12 years, but has never lost the quirks and charm that make him him. The kind of guy who talks about himself in the third person.
Brandon Spencer is probably, I would say, the modern Mandela. The perseverance that this young man has shown, the resilience, the fortitude in face of this adversity.
Brandon used to want to be an actor.
I liked it, Will Smith. That was my idol right there. Especially when I was younger, the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, that was my story. A lot of people told me I should do comedy. But I'm not really good with just free, just standing up there joking. I'm just a natural joker, so I can just say stuff off the rip.
Would you describe yourself as a goofball?
Yes, I believe I still am. A lot of people in here say that I'm always laughing and joking. So they're like, oh, that's how you cope with this. And I said, well, you know, laughter's the best medicine.
I don't know how to put it. He is like a bundle of just positivity.
This is Claudia Salinas, Brandon's attorney.
I'm a pretty positive person, and I'm always looking at, like, best case scenario. But I think he even tops me, and that's kind of tough to do.
But Brandon is also very serious, particularly about personal development.
There's this philosophy of psychology thing called post-traumatic growth. So it says that post-traumatic growth enables us in times of difficulties or struggle or traumatic experience to create a life for ourselves that's more meaningful, more purposeful, and more fulfilling than ever. So what doesn't kill you only makes you stronger. So I have that mindset that I can either be a victim and wallow in self-pity for what happened to me, or I can use this time wisely and cultivate myself and develop myself to the very best version of myself.
From Lava for Good, this is Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling.
I'm Brandon Spencer. I've been wrongfully convicted for the past 12 years.
Today, Brandon Spencer. Brandon Spencer was born November 3rd, 1992. He grew up with three siblings in a well-off upper-middle-class household in Inglewood, California.
I was born in Inglewood, California, the city of champions. Both of my parents, they both ran for public office and are highly respected. So I came from a positive home, I can say.
His family went to church together and Brandon played soccer, baseball, and did martial arts. For vacations, Brandon and his family would travel to Mississippi and St. Louis, where his parents were from.
So we kind of were like, really knew our cousins and where we came from, and I had a really good childhood. I can't really complain about it.
But Brandon says when he was 12, his parents divorced.
So that was pretty hard on me to see that separation. So that kind of played a key role in my life. Being young, I was confused. I kind of blamed myself, maybe, because my dad wasn't as around as much.
Feeling the weight of the divorce, Brandon started associating with the wrong crowds. Inglewood, California has a long history of gangs and violence. In fact, Brandon was born just months after one of the most infamous events in U.S. history. The L.A. riots. After a group of police officers were acquitted of beating Rodney King, a black man, the city erupted in anger. Protesters took to the streets and rioted for days.
The heart of every American aches at the sight of the violence, deaths, and hundreds of millions of dollars of destruction in Los Angeles. Yesterday, the violence spread to Atlanta, Seattle, San Francisco. But the pain and fear is now being felt all across this nation.
Over 50 people were killed and thousands injured. Brandon's neighborhood was hit hard. When Brandon was growing up in the 90s and early 2000s, the violent crime rate in Englewood was significantly higher than the U.S. average. Systemic and structural racism forced people to seek other means of survival, and gangs were rampant. So Brandon says his parents worried about him as a young teen, upset over the divorce. They thought he would be susceptible to the outside influence of gangs, so they tried sending him to Mississippi to live with family.
So what was living in Mississippi like?
It's slower than California. It's kind of boring. I would say because California's way faster. So out there, it's kind of like just the country.
Too slow for Brandon, so he went back to Englewood. It's what he knew. It was home. He went to a few different schools before graduating from high school in 2010 with dreams of pursuing acting. But gang life always loomed in the background.
In that environment, you have to know these people so you don't get robbed, so you don't get banged on every day about where you're from. You have to know these individuals to survive that area. In that environment, it was more gangs actively right on the corner from my house. You know, there's so I have to know these individuals just to go to the store or go to rallies. I remember one time my mom was so scared to get out the car at rallies one time. That's at the corner where we live. And I was like, Mom, don't worry about it. I go to school with these dudes. They're not going to do that. But I get their perspective because it's scary, but you have to know these people. Just like how my mom was scared, I was able to get out the car. And they're like, oh, what's up, Brandon? What you doing? I'm all just getting a burger from my mom. And she said, what y'all doing? Just sitting here being goofy. Well, that was goofy to me, like that lifestyle. Like.
Brandon says he was never part of a gang, but they were almost impossible to avoid. And the repercussions of growing up around that life would be impossible to escape.
Once upon a time, Amazon Music met audiobooks, and listeners everywhere rejoiced.
Oh, yeah.
Because now they could listen to one audiobook title a month from an enormous library of popular audiobook titles, including Romantasy, Autobiographies, True Crime, and more. Suddenly, listeners didn't mind sitting in traffic or even missing their flight. Amazon Music Unlimited now includes Audible.
No way.
Download the Amazon Music app now to start listening. Terms apply.
In the summer of 2011, Brandon went to a party at the Proud Bird Restaurant and Event Center near LAX Airport. And shortly after he arrived, shots rang out.
As I start walking, I felt like somebody kicked me in my stomach. I'm taking my shirt off, like, hold on, man. Like, something's in my stomach.
Brandon realized he'd been shot.
So I see the blood spreading out, and I'm just laying there on that ground, and slowly it seemed like I was dying.
Emergency responders raced him to the hospital.
When I went to UCLA, Ronald Reagan Medical, when they saved my life.
However, they were unable to remove the bullet lodged in his spine.
The doctor said, man, we don't know how we saved you. You know, you're not supposed to be here now.
That bullet got Brandon thinking long and hard about the company he was keeping.
I want to know better people. I want to know people that can add to my life.
So he decided to become a nurse.
I said, well, I want to give back. Hopefully I can help save others.
Brandon applied and was accepted to UCLA's EMT program. He planned to go to college the following year and was also working a licensed security job. Brandon says at 18, he was living his best life.
I had my little security job. I was working for a construction company part-time. I would pour concrete, so I was making like $47 an hour, so that was pretty fun. And, you know, I had a girlfriend. I thought I was in love at that time. And, you know, it was all something new for me. You know, and I kind of look back at those memories because they're the only memories I have. But that was very, you know, cool at that time.
But his world was about to turn upside down. On Halloween 2012, Brandon was 3 days away from turning 19. He and his then-girlfriend were looking for a Halloween party.
I never wanted to go out this night. That was one of the things, too. Like, Mike's girlfriend wanted to go to this party. I wasn't really tripping about it because my birthday was a few days after. So I was more focused on having my birthday celebration over Halloween.
But they went out anyway to a party in Hollywood.
In Hollywood, and there was a shooting. So we left and she was like, oh, there's a party at USC.
The University of Southern California.
This was around the time of when USC was, you know, a top 25 school.
This is Claudia Salinas again. She's a staff attorney at the Innocence Center based in San Diego.
I always have known it to be really good. It's a prestigious school, both the law school and the regular school.
We spoke 2 months ago about that night in 2012.
So October 31st, so close to this day of the interview, actually. So kind of wild that we're sitting here talking about it, but there was a freaks and geeks party at the USC campus.
When Brandon arrived, there were a few hundred people outside waiting to get into the party.
It seems like the party was popping because there was a line outside the door of people waiting to get in.
So we were standing in line, and then we just heard gunshots, and I just started running.
Brandon says they were only there for about 5 minutes before gunshots rang out.
There's about five gunshots, and then it turns out that four people end up getting shot.
Devontae Smith, Thomas Ritchie, My Son Downs, and Gino Hall fortunately all survived. But in the chaos, nothing was clear. Everyone was in a panic, screaming, scattering, running for their lives.
PTSD is real, so I like had that flashback of the night I got shot, and I just started running, and all that trauma came back.
As he was running, Brandon pulled off his shirt to check if he'd been shot, but he wasn't.
And I get to the parking lot, and the police pull up, like, put your hands up. I'm like, dang, what'd I do?
Police confronted Brandon in the parking lot. They were suspicious about why he was running without a shirt. They took his phone and went through it and found some photos of him with guns and other photos of what police thought were him flashing gang signs. So they took Brandon to the station. Meanwhile, on campus, police were asking questions.
They talked to two security guards, and then they also have like some other witness who provides, she said that she actually saw the shooting take place. She provides like a general description as well. Once they had like those three witnesses, they were pretty much drawn towards Brandon.
At the station, police questioned Brandon. They appeared to suspect that Brandon had taken his shirt off because it had red on it, a color associated with the Black Peastones gang.
They tried to say that was because you were trying to hide your gang colors.
That has nothing to do with gang colors. I was checking to make sure I wasn't shot again, and I had that traumatic experience. Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting there like, I know I didn't do nothing, so I'm about to go home.
But he didn't go home.
So then they come in there, like, 10 deep, pressing up against me, like, hey, you did it. Just say you did it. I said, say I did what, bro? And they're like, you know, say you did it. And then there's a detective coming in. He comes in, sits next to me, and like, rubbing my shoulder, like, look, man, we know you did it. So just go ahead and say you did it. The detective's going to come back and say you did it.
Brandon insisted he was innocent.
So then they take my arms up and put them in these, like a vanilla envelope. And I said, oh, what's this? And I'm like, oh, GSR testing. I said, oh, well, let's keep this going, bro, because, yeah, I didn't do nothing.
Gunshot residue testing. When a gun is shot, it releases microscopic particles onto hands and clothing. But nothing came up on Brandon.
And they said, well, tell us where the gun is. And I said, what gun, bro? You searched the parking lot. Y'all tested me for this GSR. You mean, bro, I didn't have no gun. I didn't do nothing.
And then 3 hours later, they end up finding a gun. And it kind of all unraveled from there. And they started building the case around him.
So that was it. So you never saw the free world again after that?
No.
Brandon was charged with four counts of attempted first-degree murder and went to trial in January of 2014. Deputy District Attorney Antonella Nistorescu told jurors that when Brandon got to the USC party, he saw a member of a rival gang, Gino Hall. She alleged that Gino had been the one who shot Brandon in 2011. She told jurors, quote, "This is a rivalry steeped in violence." Claudia says the prosecution's case really played up these gang allegations.
we were trying to count how many times the word gang was used in this case, and it's a shit ton of times.
Gang member, gang member, gang member.
The more times you hear gangs, and the more time you hear violence and tensions between the Bloods and the Crips and whatever it is, that is very inflammatory for a jury.
The prosecution also presented the photos they found on his phone of Brandon with guns and of Brandon flashing gang signs. They also introduced a photo of Brandon's chest tattoo, a BS. The prosecution said it stood for the Black Peystone Gang. Brandon says it's just his name. But Gino Hall testified at trial and did not identify Brandon as his shooter. In fact, none of the survivors implicated Brandon at trial. Only two security guards ID'd him, plus a star witness, a young man named LaPaul Lane. LaPaul was at the party and testified that he had seen Brandon confronting Gino.
He said basically that I left, came back with a gun, and the proof premeditation.
Premeditated attempted murder. The prosecution presented evidence to back up this beef between Gino and Brandon in the form of exchanges on Twitter.
Tweets of children, essentially, going back and forth between one of the victims that the prosecutor liked to use. But a lot of these words in these tweets is a lot of what they kind of call like fronting.
According to the prosecution, one of the tweets ended with Gino challenging Brandon to come and find him.
And they might be general, but they still have inflammatory parts, where then you get a police officer who gets deemed a gang expert, gets on the stand and starts making connections about what these things mean, what they see in the field. And then they do generalizations of the Peystone Bloods fueling with the Rolling 40s. And so now you have this like little bow that the gang experts get to kind of put. And you just see that throughout most of my gang cases here in the office, and it is quite inflammatory.
When I was hearing that in my trial, I'm sitting here scratching my head like, wait, I did what?
Brandon insists he was never in a gang. He was a good kid with no record.
You know, they didn't show the pictures of me at the Congressional Black Caucus when I was 15. I met Obama, and the pictures with me were Maxine Waters and different congressional people. But the court allows this lady who doesn't know me to tell 12 people lies that I'm just this thug, I'm this criminal, I'm well-documented. Stereotype is, for someone that looks like me, is
right.
A gang member, a thug, a criminal, and my jury just goes off of that.
The judge even criticized the prosecution for this, displaying things to the jury without offering evidence. He said, quote, "This is an improper and unprofessional move on your part. I don't know if you're lazy or you're nervous, or you don't know how to do that." There was no physical evidence linking Brandon to the crime. There were no fingerprints on the gun. However, law enforcement did recover a partial DNA profile.
They said that there was a 1 in 40 chance that that was a hit to Brandon, whereas the shirt was a 1 in 7 sextillion chance.
A 1 in 40 comparison can include way too many people compared to a conclusive ID like Brandon's shirt, which was also tested.
So the shirt, there's no doubt that it is his shirt. Like, there was no contest there that it's his. But the gun, to go on the stand and tell jurors that 1 in 40 chance, like, no, nobody really understands what that means. And it's too many people that can be included into that lump sum. But they don't take that extra step to kind of explain that at that level.
So I'm sitting here the whole time like, well, the evidence proves, there's no GSR, my fingerprints on this gun, my DNA's not on this gun.
But Brandon's defense was weak. His girlfriend, who was with him at the party and could say Brandon wasn't the shooter, wasn't called to testify, even though she was his alibi. And it's unclear why. Still, Brandon was hopeful.
There's no video evidence. Like, the jury's common sense, like, the evidence proves that I had nothing to do with this.
But stacked against police officers, a key witness, gang experts, and a climate of fear and crime in Los Angeles, Brandon was convicted of 4 counts of attempted murder.
Wait, hold on, bro. What's going on? Are we playing right now? Or is it serious?
Do you think the jury was thinking like, well, even if he didn't do this, he's in a gang, so he did something bad?
Exactly. I could tell looking at my jury, that's all they saw. They didn't see Brandon. I didn't see the security guard, the young man who never had a record, the young man who, a mayor of a city, would speak highly of.
Before sentencing, one of the survivors said that he knew Brandon, and he didn't think Brandon would do this. He asked the judge to be lenient with his sentencing. A sergeant in the LAPD's 77th Division, familiar with gang activity, called Brandon a, quote, nice, respectable young man. Even the mayor of Inglewood vouched for Brandon. But after 3 hours of deliberating, the jury found him guilty. And Brandon lost it.
I kind of like blacked out. I threw the chair and was tussling with the sheriff's department. I told him, you know, just kill me. You know, that was my mindset at that time. I said, you might as well just go ahead and shoot me right now because you didn't took it too far now. Like, and like, that was like a powerless moment in my life.
As to count three, a conviction of Penal Code Section 664.
On April 18th, 2014, the judge sentenced Brandon to 15 years to life on four attempted murder convictions, running concurrently.
The minimum period of parole eligibility is 15 years plus 25 years to life in accordance with Penal Code Section 12022.
Plus 25 years to life for gun enhancements, all made worse by the alleged gang retaliation. As the judge read the sentence, Brandon sobbed.
This is to be concurrent.
Sitting there with his hands cuffed behind his back, he banged his head against the table. And he pleaded with the judge.
Sorry for what happened here, honey, but I can't do life in prison. And I'm not a bad person, but I made mistakes. But I'm not just some gangbanger that she tried to betray me as.
But it didn't matter. Brandon was sentenced to 40 years to life at 21 years old for four shots that killed no one.
Once upon a time, Amazon Music met audiobooks, and listeners everywhere rejoiced.
Oh, yeah.
Because now they could listen to one audiobook title a month from an enormous library of popular audiobook titles, including Romantasy, Autobiographies, True Crime, and more. Suddenly, listeners didn't mind sitting in traffic or even missing their flight. Amazon Music Unlimited now includes Audible.
No way.
Download the Amazon Music app now to start listening. Terms apply.
After his sentencing, a column came out in the LA Times. The author was Sandy Banks.
I'm a journalist who worked with the Los Angeles Times for more than 30 years. Most of that as a columnist covering issues that might be missed by others, but that it were roiling the community.
The column held no punches. In it, Sandy called out Brandon for throwing a tantrum at his sentencing. She called him a two-year-old and wrote that the last thing LA needed was more hoodlums carrying guns.
What got me there was that here was this young man who had kind of a glowing resume, except for a couple of mishaps in his young teenage years. And yet he was about to go to prison for 40 years for shooting into a crowd of kids. And initially I thought that's really pretty dramatic and overkill. But then I thought back to how many times people in my community and the greater Los Angeles community felt threatened by young men with guns. I'm the mother of three girls who were teenagers at that point. And I don't have enough fingers to count the times they had encountered the potential for shootings or violence. And so I just felt like he was a representative in my mind of all these young men who were willy-nilly shooting to settle their scores and don't seem concerned about, you know, the collateral damage.
Her column was merciless.
I called him a crybaby and, you know, just a thug with a gun.
And Brandon read it.
And that gang stuff is actually kind of disrespectful that I'm associated with that. That's not who I am. And then that's been like a repeat thing with someone that looks like me, is that they're ignorant, they're thugs, they're criminals, and that hurts.
Brandon says his entire being was reduced simply to thug. He stewed on Sandy's article. Brandon wouldn't be eligible for parole until 2031. But he wanted to prove everyone wrong. He wasn't who they thought he was, and he needed to make sure he had the best shot he could at parole. So he continued his education and personal development.
He has done so much schooling, like probably more than any of the other clients that I personally have worked with, at least. He's in the dog care program, so he helps train dogs for veterans and for people who want to adopt these dogs.
I've taken full ownership of my life. I've been able to not embrace a victim's attitude. I became a constant learner. That's my new philosophy, to remain a lifelong learner. Brandon Spencer is striving to be the best version of himself.
The whole time hoping something would break in his case. Then, 6 years after being arrested, it happened. In 2018, the prosecution's star witness recanted. In a written affidavit, LaPaul Lane said that he was threatened by law enforcement and the prosecution.
He actually had some pending criminal charges at the time, and that is leverage to be able to negotiate a deal. I can't pretend to imagine what it's like to be under those circumstances. So that is what he talks about in the declaration.
LaPaul's affidavit reads,
I was threatened by the detectives investigating the case and by the district attorney prosecuting the case that if I did not say what they needed me to say, that the district attorney would intervene in my own pending criminal case and cause me to be harmed or sentenced more severely. I am sincerely sorry that I testified falsely against Mr. Spencer, but I was afraid of what the prosecutor would do to me if I didn't.
He also does describe some of the six-pack identification procedures from what he remembers, and the specifics that he has about that does raise a couple red flags.
Here's a reading of the affidavit again.
Detective Jones had me review at least 3 six-packs of photographs to try to get me to identify Brandon Spencer. The first 3 six-packs were of black men wearing black shirts, except that in each six-pack, the photograph of Mr. Spencer was at least twice the size of the other photographs, and Mr. Spencer was wearing a red shirt. When the detective asked me if any of the men looked familiar, of course, I pointed to the larger photograph with the red instead of black shirt. After, the detective showed me another 6-pack of photographs, but this time all the photographs were the same size. I was told to circle and initial the photograph of Mr. Spencer on the last 6-pack only. I don't know what the detective did with the other lineups, but afterward I was allowed to leave.
Finally, Brandon felt like he had something, but it took years of fighting his case on his own to make any headway.
He is his greatest advocate. And I don't know that, you know, had he not had that really strong advocacy and positivity and willingness to help in his own case, that he would have gone as far as he has gone today and got the attention of the people that he needs to get the attention of.
Like Claudia and the Innocence Center, who officially started working on Brandon's case this year.
He did have a recantation. And so for us, you know, you always got to look at those with some kind of scrutiny. But it had a lot of information in there about the 6-pack identification procedures, about some of the potential coercion that took place during the identification and investigation process. And so that kind of opened the door into kind of just, okay, well, what's this case about?
The shooting took place on USC campus, a prestigious institution.
They had a reputation to uphold, and of course, nobody wants there to be just a bunch of shootings taking place. But it certainly doesn't help that 6 months prior to this Halloween night shooting, there was a prior shooting of 2 USC students, Ming and Ying, who were actually shot and killed on campus as well.
They were killed in an apparent robbery, so the rush to arrest and prosecute someone in this second shooting became clear, Claudia says. Then she focused on the sentence. 40 years to life for a shooting where no one died. But the judge actually gave Brandon the lowest possible sentence he could. That's because of mandatory minimums. Sentences that require a minimum prison term for certain crimes, regardless of mitigating circumstances. Mandatory minimums are just one of many policies from the tough on crime era that still exist today. Brandon was given the minimum for each crime, 15 years to life on 4 attempted murder convictions, running concurrently, plus 25 years to life for a gun enhancement.
I think that, you know, the United States is working the way it's intended to, right? Which is to create castes of people and incarcerate people, specifically Black and brown people and other minorities. And so I'm actually sadly not surprised that, you know, he got such a big sentence. You know, a person in like a white supremacist type of gang, you typically don't see them getting the gang enhancement as much as your typical Blood or Crip gang.
Claudia points to examples from trial where this bias was on display, like the photo and videos the prosecution showed the jury of Brandon flashing gang signs.
If you grow up in a gang neighborhood, these are the people that you're associated with, whether, you know, you're put onto the gang or not.
The gang signs, I would say that I was young, just being goofy, mm-hmm. just kicking it, hanging it. And those pictures that they used, I was like 15 and 16.
But nonetheless, you know, a jury doesn't necessarily know that. You don't necessarily have a jury of your peers. So what you're seeing is these kind of inflammatory pictures that were allowed.
But Claudia says there's actually a new law in California that could be beneficial to helping Brandon, specifically in these avenues. It's called the Racial Justice Act.
It's meant to target issues of the government or a prosecutor, a judge, a juror, a law enforcement officer, even an attorney, if they exhibit actual bias or implicit bias or any kind of amicus towards the suspect or the defendant because of their race, ethnicity, or origin. So this is great. This is like a mode to be able to look into gang enhancements. Are the prosecutors applying the gang enhancement at the same rate for the same similar circumstances to white people that they are to Black or brown people?
She also says it's being used in the over-criminalization of rap lyrics.
Rap lyrics are one of like the prominent issues that are going on in California. They finally have some legal standard to be able to attack those because we do know that rap lyrics are an expression of art, and it does not always necessarily mean that this person did this crime. And it is more inflammatory for people who might not listen to rap music on a general basis and understand that context.
If I was tweeting those lyrics and beefing with somebody else, the assumption might not be she's in a gang because I'm a white woman.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he was a Black guy. And it's like, oh, he's tweeting these. He's a Black kid. He's in a gang.
Absolutely, yeah. And then same with, you know, the guns that were on the phone. You know, I can think of many times that I've seen guns on my friends' phones, but they're lawyers and they wear suits. And so it's not the same.
She also sees using the Racial Justice Act to examine the way the prosecution used the tweets between Brandon and Gino Hall.
Some of the tweets had the word gunplay in them. In 2012, when this case occurred, Gunplay was actually one of the artists that were like peaking in the hip hop kind of industry at the time too. Mm. So that context didn't necessarily get to come out at trial, but it's all very important information. Are there different ways that these tweets can be interpreted? And if so, then was the gang expert, you know, using some type of racial bias to apply these to him? They also tried to use like his tattoos. I know tattoos are coming up in the Racial Justice Act as well. And so that could be an option.
Claudia says she's excited to take on Brandon's case because of how many potential avenues into court there are.
There's some cases that we run into where it's like, I can believe in this person's innocence all I want, but there's no areas of investigation. It was literally just the testimony of like one person. You know, that's not the case here. There's a few different red flags and areas that we can pursue, and that always just makes me much more excited.
She's also going to look into more DNA testing since science has advanced. And of course, regular shoe leather investigation.
It's my hope to track down some of the people that were involved so we can talk to them directly. The security guards from the USC, they were pretty significant prosecution witnesses, and I'd love to see some of the circumstances around what happened with the six-pack identification procedures. You know, you just want to get out there. You want to You want to talk to the people and just figure out what happened, really. I think that's kind of what we all want, is we want the truth to come out. And that's exciting for me. That's why I got into this work, for sure.
Brandon has been in prison for over a decade for a crime he says he didn't commit, and he continues to work on himself. He says next, he wants to get his PhD.
I want to do my dissertation about post-traumatic growth, like I was saying earlier. Hopefully become a motivational speaker and help young men, you know, change their mindset and understand that lifestyle, that way of thinking is ignorant.
And another person has also spent years reflecting on her mindset. Sandy Banks has had time to look back on her column about Brandon.
I wrote a column that, when I read it now, kind of embarrasses me, because it was so knee-jerk. And I realized I was biased by the fact that I worry about my girls every time they would leave the house, you know, when they're going to a party or a football game or whatever. And that shouldn't be what's, you know, steering my opinion. You know, it's tough as a columnist because you're supposed to have an opinion, and we try to explain why we have this opinion. But me being worried for my girls is not a valid reason for making Brandon the symbol of gang violence in the city.
In 2020, I released an episode about Brandon on my podcast, Unjust and Unsolved. A listener sent it to Sandy after reading her article. Sandy saw the name Brandon Spencer and listened.
I got to see him and hear him. And it was a very different experience than, you know, watching the scene in the courtroom unfold where he's screaming and carrying on. It was a young man who was kind of perplexed himself about how he got there and who proclaimed his innocence still and, you know, and had things to back him up.
So Sandy started taking stock of her own experiences as a Black woman.
And I will tell you, I live in the San Fernando Valley, which is, you know, reputationally very white. There have been times that I have been considered suspicious. I can remember walking home from a Whole Foods with Whole Foods bags, but I had a hoodie on and my hair wasn't combed and I was, you know, and there was a guy following me in the car. And I realized, you know, I'm going to be on the Nextdoor feed next time about the suspicious Black lady who might be homeless because she's walking around with shopping bags, you know, and that would not happen to a white neighbor. So, yeah, I'm aware of that. And that's kind of, you know, I should have thought of that even when I was castigating him.
Sandy and Brandon connected after she listened to my episode.
When she finally got to hear me and talk to me, you know, I kind of get emotional. I got in tears when I spoke to her that, you know, that now she supports me and she apologized to me. And that really was motivational.
I think we need to be able to step back to plunge deeper into the backgrounds of the people that are, you know, quote unquote, doing the shooting, because that's what's going to give us the answer on how we be a less violent society. Talking to them, listening to them, having programs in prisons to help them see the light, you know.
Sandy also spoke to Brandon's parents for context for her most recent column about Brandon, titled, I Once Applauded a 40-Year Sentence for a Shooter, Not Now.
His parents are good people. They did the best they can and are heartbreaking too and are still working every day to free their son. What he did, if he's guilty, was certainly wrong. But is 40 years in prison an appropriate sentence for that when you have, you know, child molesters and, you know, other kind of guys getting out after, you know, 5 or 6 years? And I think we need to kind of embrace the notion that these are young people growing up in difficult times. And aren't there ways that we can help and support them instead of just, you know, castigate them when they do wrong?
And that's exactly what Brandon wants to do now.
I want to help other young men not get involved or caught up with that or don't even be associated with that, because me being, knowing these people got me my license, and I just want to go home and live my life. I'm an asset to society. I'm not a liability. You know, at one time I was suicidal. I'd rather have been dead than where I am today. You know, and to see who I've become now is very inspiring. And I believe it's motivational to show other people that we all face struggles in our lives, but we're not defined by those moments. It's about pushing forward. You know, look at me. I've been railroaded by a system that everyone in America and the world knows that is designed for someone that looks like me to fail that. But all the odds right now are stacked against me. This is the modern David versus Goliath. I'm going against USC. This is a $1 billion college. I'm going against Los Angeles Police Department and, you know, harnessing that and embracing struggle and, you know, don't wallow in your self-pity. You know, I just want my justice. I want to get free, and I hope that we're able to speak on the facts and I'm able to be exonerated one day and receive the justice I deserve.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. Please support your local innocence organizations and go to the links on our website to see how you can help Brandon. This episode was written by me, Maggie Freeling, with story editing and sound design by senior producer Rebecca Ibarra. Our producer is Kathleen Fink. Our mixer is Josh Allen, with research by Allison Levy and additional production help by Jeff Clyburn. Executive producers are Jason Flom, Jeff Kempler, and Kevin Wordis. The music is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Make sure to follow us on all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on all platforms at Maggie Freeling. Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling is a production of Lava for Good podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1. We have worked hard to ensure that all facts reported in this show are accurate. The views and opinions expressed by the individuals featured in this show are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Lava for Good.
Buying a car in Carvana was so easy. I was able to finance it through them.
Whoa, wait, you mean finance?
Yeah, finance. Got pre-qualified for a Carvana auto loan, entered my terms, and shopped from thousands of great car options all within my budget.
That's cool that financing through Carvana was so easy.
Financed. Done. And I get to pick up my car from their Carvana vending machine tomorrow.
Financed.
Right, that's what I said.
You can spend time trying to pronounce financing, or you can actually finance and buy your car today on
Carvana.
Financing subject to credit approval. Additional terms and conditions may apply.